and Devin for answering the phone today, and thank you for coming along. The music I'm finishing up with right now is Tony Monaco. He's coming to town next week, Thursday, going to be performing at the Brink Lounge in a Madison Jazz Festival event. This is Backward Shack from Burnin' Grooves. Otherwise, have a good week, and come back again next week for more music from all around the world.
News with David Austin. Families in the Turkish town of Soma have been burying their dead after the country's worst ever mining accident, while demonstrations took place across the country. More than 200 bodies have been recovered from the mine since Tuesday's explosion. Hopes are fading for the survival of those still missing. Earlier, visiting the scene of the disaster, Turkey's president, Abdullah Gül, called for unity. Here's James Reynolds.
At the main cemetery in Soma, a team of grave diggers prepares a row of graves. An official holding a loudspeaker organizes a succession of miners' funerals. In his right hand, he holds a collection of yellow tags. The names of the miners buried here are written on the tags in felt-tip pen. They'll serve as interim headstones. Rescue workers continue to look for more than 100 miners still trapped underground. No one knows if they are alive or dead.
President Obama has described a memorial museum dedicated to the September the 11th attacks in 2001 as a sacred place of healing and hope. He was speaking to rescuers and survivors as he inaugurated the museum, which has been built on the site of the former World Trade Center in New York.
No act of terror can match the strength or the character of our country. Like the Great Wall and bedrock that embrace us today, nothing can ever break us. Nothing can change who we are as Americans.
The World Trade Center was destroyed when hijackers flew planes into its twin towers. Demonstrators in Brazil have blocked main roads into Sao Paulo at the start of a nationwide day of anti-government protests. They burned tires and have been causing severe disruption during rush hour traffic in Brazil's biggest city. The protesters say they want the government to spend billions of dollars on social projects, transport and housing, instead of the Football World Cup, which Brazil hosts next month. Protests have been planned in 50 cities and towns. Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has announced plans to reinterpret the country's pacifist constitution to allow the military to use greater force. But Japan's neighbours and some of its own citizens remain wary of changes. Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from Tokyo.
Prime Minister Shinzo Abe wants Japan's military to be allowed to defend allied countries and allied forces if they are attacked. He wants Japan's UN peacekeepers to be armed and to be allowed to defend themselves. And he wants to be able to send Japanese troops to rescue Japanese citizens in peril abroad. It all sounds very reasonable. The problem is, Mr. Abe wants to do all of this without changing Japan's peace constitution.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes. World News from the BBC.
And you're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison and WORT HD.
WORT 89.9 FM is looking for a dynamic, self-motivated individual to help us grow our digital home, WORTFM.org. You should be skilled at wrangling a content management system. Currently, we use WordPress, and at understanding what makes for great online content. You'll develop content based largely on the activity of the station's 300-plus FM radio producers and its handful of program and administrative staff whom you will help to bring into the digital sphere. Compensation will be $32,000 to $38,000 per year, commensurate with experience, plus a generous benefit package including health, dental, and paid vacation. To apply, send your resume, a cover letter detailing your qualifications, and 3 professional references to jobs@wortfm.org. Applications are due by 5 p.m. on Friday, May 30th, to ensure consideration. WORT is an equal opportunity affirmative action employer.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and ResTech Services, a locally owned and operated internet, digital phone, direct TV, and low voltage wiring provider for multi-dwelling communities and businesses. On the web at restechservices.net or by phone at 608-663-3868.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. You know, I thought we'd have a discussion about education today, about our schools. And more pointedly, what I view as the assault, the attack on public education. You know, I recently went to 2 events. One at Monona Terrace, a larger event featuring Karen Lewis of the Chicago Teachers Union and Texas education advocate John Kuhn. A big event, and and then that was followed up by an event last week at Edgewood College, an event billed as Reclaiming the Conversation, and I hoped we'd continue this conversation on the air today. That event at Edgewood College was organized by Tim Slecker, who is Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood. Tim began his career in education as a second grade teacher in Williamsburg, Virginia, and later taught 5th grade in York, Pennsylvania. He attended the University of Maryland at College Park, where he earned his PhD in social studies education. Dr. Slecker has worked with 7th and 8th grade teachers in the city of Baltimore. He's published in numerous prestigious education journals. Prior coming to Edgewood College, last fall, huh?
I did, yeah. I just got here in June.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, so before coming to Edgewood, to Madison, he was at the Pennsylvania State Altoona for 2 years, where he was responsible for building an elementary education program and leading the Division of Education, Human Development, and Social Services. And it's good to have a engaged... I don't even want to call you an academic because you're really not. But a scholar and an activist in the field, though. Welcome.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me in. You know, that was one of the things that I've been interviewed and people say, you know, well, so are you an academic? Are you an activist? And it's like, well, I think one of the things that I do is that I'm trying to, you know, again, using this kind of more cliche, reclaiming the conversation. Academics have an activist responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
We have it, but we've forgotten that. We've forgotten to say the things that matter, the things that, you know, there's a reason why there's institutions of higher education. There's a reason why we engage in research. There's a reason why knowledge exists out there. For some reason in the past 40 years, we've decided that, you know, that's just not something we share with the public. However, when it comes to education, particularly public education, think about this, you know, what more... Why is the research on public education something that's sacred and that academics should hold to themselves? In fact, it should be shared widely. And in fact, I think that's probably the biggest reason we're in the dilemma we're in right now, is because not enough academics have been out there explaining, particularly the right-wing attack on the public system, the whole idea, you know, and so... We're to blame. And so I don't know that I'm not an academic as much as I'm saying I've got the academic credentials, but I'm out finally saying, and this is what you should know and hear, because what you hear from the other side is basic nonsense.
You know, it gets right back to the whole role of the public intellectual.
Right.
That is, you know, the people give lip service here in Madison. You know, you're a relative newcomer, but you hear it incessantly about the Wisconsin idea.
Right. Right.
And what was the Wisconsin idea? The people from the university publicly engaged, not just to make policy, but to have exchange with the citizenry about the issues of the day. So, again, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's jump right in here. There is this concerted assault. It's global at some levels.
Right.
Of this concerted assault on public education, public schools. What is the intent? You know, it's framed in terms of we have to reform our failing schools.
Right.
But what, in your estimate, in the broad sense, is going on?
As you said, global, first of all, it is global, and it has an acronym like everything else, GERM, G-R-M, the Global Education Reform Movement, which is this whole process. The idea is to create the illusion of mass failure of the public system. So it's not just, you know, it's a total collapse of the public system, and therefore the neoliberal market-based ideology is what's going to fix it. And so you're going to go in and get – the problem is that the evidence of failure, of broad, wide failure, just doesn't exist. Our failure exists where it's existed for ever since we can, you know, imagine. In low, high poverty, concentrated ethnic minorities, you know, in our cities, in our rural areas, the places where we fail constantly and continually and historically to address issues of equitable funding. That's the failing system. But that's not what you hear. Instead, the global assault says that all public schools are failing, kids aren't learning, people have to compete in a global workforce, and that therefore the schools aren't doing their job and we need to really ramp them up. The problem is that I would say, and this is where I come back as an academic, please show me the evidence for this collapse and this mass failure. Because particularly from America's point of view, the last time I checked, we were the economic superpower in the world, even though we have low to middle international test scores. So the connection between test scores and economic competitiveness, obviously, first of all, it's been shown, it doesn't exist. You know, and plus those test scores are invalid. But it's an attack on public. Let's be honest about it. You know, there's a group of people that do have, and I've met a guy, and I have respect for this guy who came out and said, you know, look, public schools are socialistic institutions, and I don't believe they should be in America. At least I can come out and go, okay, I know where you're coming from, and he won't hide it in facts that really don't exist. This guy's just coming out and saying, as a libertarian who says, you know, look, this is a socialist institution. You know, you should pay. If you have kids, you take care of your own kids. It's not my job to provide tax money for you to raise your own children. Okay, great. You know, at least he's honest. I disagree with him. But the idea, though, to create what we've got going on here is a false narrative of mass failure so that the public, who actually likes their own public schools, will start to buy in and allow people to do things to their public schools that you could never imagine. The only way they can do that, though, is if you create this ethos, this failing constant, you know, narrative. Right. It, once, you know, he's like, yeah, my school's failing. We need to do something about it. I don't care what, but whatever it is, fix it, please, because it's failing.
So let's be specific, a little concrete here.
Yeah.
What's the why and the who? Who is pushing this and why?
You know,
I mean, it's
people will say ALEC, the, you know, American Legislative Exchange Council, Bill Gates, hedge fund managers, different people that are pushing this, you know, that have this, you know, agenda that doesn't fit with the idea of education as being this liberal arts liberating, you know, platform, that it's job training. You know, and so therefore the failing schools really aren't failing schools. They're just failing to respond and report directly to what industry wants. I mean, that's really the failure they're talking about. And so you have the Chamber of Commerce all lined up behind this. You have groups of people that really have said, you know, we need better job training. as opposed to better education, which is really silly. You know, I learned that first. You know, if you know anything about punk, old punk rock, I interviewed Henry Rollins once on my little talk show at the Chalk Face, and he made the greatest point, saying that why in the world would we defund education anywhere if we truly wanted to be the superpower of the world? Because wouldn't you want everybody to be smart? Now, I don't know if I kind of went around on that and come back, but who's, you know, it's a right, and it's not just right. We have to also remember that there's a neoliberal approach to this. Rahm Emanuel, a Democrat, Andrew Cuomo, a Democrat from New York, are highly behind Arnie Duncan, our Secretary of Education. These people are supportive of a movement and of an eradication of what we do in public schools and an implementation of a system that is absolutely designed more specifically for job training than it has anything to do with education for the masses. And that's a problem.
You're listening to Timothy Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. We're talking about a broad range of education issues. And today, part of that, reclaiming the conversation that Dr. Slecker and others have inaugurated here in Madison as part of a broader education to bring people into motion around in defense of public schools. We'll be opening up the phones in a while at 256-2001. So why this drive to discredit public education? We kind of touched on it. That is, there's this kind of corporate view. But I think there's something, you know, and you touched on it already in this reference to this libertarian point. But it seems very diverse. I mean, you already said you have Democrat. It's bipartisan.
There's a bipartisan assault on public education, right? What is the? Let me go ahead. Finish your.
So. Yeah, no. There's this kind of instrumentalist that schooling versus education.
There you go.
Is all important.
Right.
That you have to have the, everything for the 21st century.
Right.
American competitiveness and so on, but in the meantime, they've attacked critical thinking, critical
right.
liberal arts education,
right.
The things that I look back at I can actually talk about the teachers that in a sense saved me.
Right.
And they weren't technicians.
Well, that's what matters. And in fact, a great scholar out of China, a Chinese immigrant, Yang Zhao, take a look at him. I mean, he's probably one of the biggest proponents who comes out of a very job-oriented training system of education and is now here in America. He's at Portland State, Yang Zhao. And he writes constantly about the fact that we are what we are engaging in, which is this kind of sterilization of education, making it a job training place as opposed to an educational, way to reimagine the world, critical thinking, or all those things. He said that's what made the American system, even when it was failing its most disadvantaged students, the schools that were working incredibly well because they were focused on this bigger, larger idea of education, not job training. And so simple, standardized job training, though, is actually, that's what people need to fear. So when somebody says, we need to fix our schools, I always ask them and say, fix them to do what? Right? Well, we're failing globally in the economy. And I always say, well, where's your evidence for that we're failing globally? Well, our test scores. Okay, you know what? Let me tell you something about test scores. I already hinted to this. First of all, we have, since they've been doing international test scores, America has constantly scored at the middle and the bottom, 50 years, constantly. Okay. Now, look at the economic, where we are economically. Okay. Now, depending on your point of view, you may say we're an economic disaster. But still, when it comes to, economic competitiveness, okay, so the connection between those test scores. However, when we do look at those test scores, we also have to, we never ever talk about them in an apples-to-apples way, which is when we look at Singapore's test scores, who's taking those tests versus who's taking the tests here in America. Okay, when we compare our, the same, our wealthy upper middle class white, essentially white kids, right? They, once you pull their scores out and disaggregate the data, they're at the top, above the top in the international test scores, which of course, you know, it makes sense because they're getting a great education in the American public schools. However, they also, you know, we understand the connection of all of the other externalities outside of the public school that actually help with learning, okay? And so that's this conversation that I think we want to start really having is that to start moving away from saying that schools are failing and start realizing what's failing, as John Kuhn said the other night, is that we constantly fail to not address our most vulnerable populations, and that's always been a weakness of American public schools. And this distraction of test scores keeps us from looking at the real reason of what we have to do with those most vulnerable schools, and that's looking at issues of socioeconomic conditions and poverty.
Mm-hmm. So why the constant emphasis, and it keeps on going through various, for years now, mm-hmm. iterations of the need for standardized testing?
Yeah, well, if you listen, one of the needs is so that we can compare. You know, you and I need to be compared. Now, I've started to work with people and ask people to say, when you hear that, ask them, follow that question up with why. Why do Alan and Tim need to be compared? You know, on a standard metric that tells if one is more like the other or not, because it's really, we don't really need this. And so people have talked about, you know, it's going to be great. We're going to know that kids in Mississippi and kids in the state of Washington and kids in the state of Oregon who are all in third grade in October, we're going to know if they're all okay. You know, meaning whether they're meeting standards or not, because they're going to be at the same level with mass standardization. You're going to have the same, you know, curriculum based on a common core idea of concepts based on a test score that's going to constantly measure them so that we can make these comparisons. Well, educationally, there's no benefit to knowing where a kid is in Washington, Mississippi, and Maine compares to each other. I mean, there's really, okay, great. So now I know that so-and-so is a little bit less, but it doesn't help me in any way. It's actually because we can do it. It's one of those things, hey, we can sell you this technology. Now, here's what you can do with it. You can compare kids across states. Now, is that helpful in any way? We don't care, but it's really cool to compare people. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's the academic side. What are you comparing? You know, why are you comparing? What is it that gives us? And usually, though, what it'll come down to, what the real issue is it's not comparison. What we want to use the test scores and the standardization for is so that we can make judgments as to who's doing better. Mm-hmm. Because if you have a diverse public education system committed to different ideas, there's always been a national curriculum. Don't fool yourself, right? We know what we take in certain grades. There's always been this. But there's been a slight local flair of diversity. And in fact, going back to Yung Zhao, he's always said that that's what makes the American system of public education great, is the diversity there. And so, but the comparison model, the reason the focus on high stakes tests, and particularly standardized tests and standardized curriculum, is this so that I can say, Alan, your school is doing better than Tim's school. That's what it's all about. And so that we can blame. It's in a, you know, it has nothing to do with saying who's going to do better or not. It's about trying to create this field of competitiveness because, again, we're coming out of this business ethos model that says that the best way you create better education is to create competition between people. Well, the only way you can create competition is if you have a somewhat standard metric to say, well, we each know, according to this metric, that Alan is here, Tim is here, and Joe X is there. And if we know that they're all on the same metric at the same point, we can tell you who's winning and who's not winning.
You're listening to Timothy Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. Again, we'll be opening up the phones very shortly at 256-2001. But at some levels, it involves money and funding. Mm-hmm. That is, there's this increasing move to peg teacher merit pay and hiring and so on and so forth, advancement
right.
To, you know, Teacher X, you can...
Well, you can measure... First of all, it's this cult of objectivity, this cult of metrification, this idea that we, for some reason, we think we can measure everything. And if we can't measure it, and it's not worth looking at, which is absolute nonsense, first of all. But the idea of Merope, this is a great one. I'm glad you brought that up. I forget where the paper comes from. It comes out of Educational Leadership, and I forget the author's name, but there's a study done that looks at Merope all the way back as far as the 1700s, and it has failed. The recommendations coming out of at the end of the 1800s was, Merope doesn't increase it doesn't create better results. It narrows the curriculum. It creates an unhealthy form of competition between teachers because it recognizes that teaching and learning isn't a Merope based thing. But, you and I aren't as teachers foes. We're supposed to be teachers who collaborate and do things together. We shouldn't be competitive with each other. We should be, in fact, if I find something that works, I should be sharing it with you. Instead, this competitive ethos. So it's a problem,
Right, but it's also at the level of, the aggregate numbers for your school or your school district or your city or whatever haven't improved or are falling behind, and then what? Federal and state money possibly right, pegged to that.
Right, we attach different money for one of the first silly things with No Child Left Behind when it came out early in 2001 is that as schools did poorly, they lost money. Because that came out of this really crazy you can't keep throwing money at the problem. Oh, so the answer then is to take money away from the problem. Which was, of course, silly, but people liked that idea because it was that's my hard-earned tax dollars. But so now, though, we say, we're going to give you money. But at the same time, this is what the news and other media won't tell you, is that the amount of budget destructive slashing that has occurred to public schools over the past 20 years, just to provide, so you do that and then come back at the same time and say, but we're going to give you $1 million if you do X. See, that's, and if you score X, I'm not sure that that's actually funding schools to create competitive, innovative places as much as that's extortion to get people to do things the way you want them to be done. Which is, for me, again, if you look at what's being asked to be implemented, which is this very standard, very sterile, very non-creative curriculum. Well, then you get it. You go, that's cheap. That's what they really, you're really looking for cheap. And I've asked people who talk about this, when I talk about ed reform, I said, why? Here's a great question, and it actually comes out of a Dewey quote. But the best question is to look at and go, okay, every one of these reformers who tells you that this is what's best for my kid, 99.9% of them, if they have children, their children are in schools that are doing absolutely nothing that they're advocates for.
Take that deeper.
Well, very simple, right? So the Gates family sends young Bill off to private schooling, small class sizes, extensive resources, amazing thing. Bill now comes out and advocates that best teachers can teach, class size doesn't matter, all this, it's all about teaching. But yet, again, their own family still. Mitt Romney came out, he was classic during the presidential, the campaign of 2012. He came out and did the old class size doesn't matter. He was in a school and he said, we know class size doesn't matter. And if I'd have been there and if somebody else would have been there, he would have said, well, how come you spend $40,000 a year to send your own or to have sent your own kids to places that advertise that you don't get anything but small class sizes? I thought class sizes didn't matter, Mr. Romney. Okay? Class size does matter.
Of course
it matters, And so if somebody's willing to pay... And I say this, too. You want to go deeper. So if somebody's willing to pay $40,000 a year for something that's public that you cannot get, and what they're saying is that I don't want you to have what my kids get. So look at all of the advocates for public school reform. I said, look exactly, look at them. and ask what it is they're advocating for. John Dewey said, here's, you know, and this is a paraphrase, look, what the best in this country, what the most elite in this country have as a baseline for their children must be what we insist that we have for all children. Because that's what public education is devoted to, is devoted to equity for all kids. Not, you know, and so that's one thing. But I always say, if somebody's paying $40,000 a year to avoid the reform movement that the public school is being put under, that tells you it's not the best, right? If I have enough money to get my kids out of the public school system because I don't want them in large classes, I don't want them missing the arts, I don't want them missing music, I don't want them not having field trips, I don't want, you know, well, then that tells you, you know, that reforms are not the best that they're advocating.
Let's talk about the issue of poverty. You touched on it very briefly. I've noticed in you know, my observations that there's this tendency of those that who advocate, whether it be on a local level in Madison or at the national, even international level, that the problems are inside, are all caused by what goes on or doesn't go on inside the schools.
Right.
And that all the various metrics, as we say,
right,
of the social metrics, everything that goes on outside the school, poverty, hunger, you name it, they don't matter. The schools can solve that.
And that's the silliest. Okay, so now all the way back to the beginning of the show, why become an activist when you're an academic? Because exactly what you just said, there is absolutely nothing true about what you just said. Okay, and I mean this empirically from a research base over 40 years. Okay, yes, great teachers, great classrooms, things like that help. However, by our best studies, and in fact, the American Statistical Association just came out within the past month and released a study of looking at test score gains and seeing what contributes the most to test score gains. And they said, at best, 14% of the variability is the teacher's, is the teacher effect. The rest, everything else that determined that those test scores occurred outside of the school, of the place where you just said. So issues of sleeping in cars, issues of hunger, issues of access to books, issues of access to health care, issues to access of safe neighborhoods. In other words, poverty, right? And so poverty does matter. When you say, look, you, if you're a great teacher, you can overcome poverty, that's really an excuse to say, me as a politician, as a legislator, I either am being paid to tell you to not look at poverty, or I don't want to deal with poverty, and I'd much rather blame it on teachers than the public school system. But again, your teachers are not going to solve the poverty problem, because we have David Berliner, Gene Glass now just came out with a brand new book, 50 Myths and Lies That Are, you know, that are Going to Hurt American Public Schools. Largely, this has been based on David Berliner's research that he's been doing for the longest time, which quantifies empirically that the biggest issue affecting a child's achievement, and let's not even call it achievement, but success in school, are socioeconomic outside of the school factors. And if we are not willing as a nation to address those issues, then we need to be okay with accepting that teachers and schools are going to do their darndest, but they're never going to overcome structural inequities, structural racial discrimination that's been around historically, and particularly the issues that deal with poverty. Because poverty is a really, really deep thing. In fact, I had a conversation with somebody. It was a bit frightening because I'm talking about poverty, and I said, you know, well, look, poverty really matters. And then this, they said, no, it doesn't. In fact, you know, we've done studies of school breakfast and lunch programs, and you know, the places where they have school lunch and breakfast programs, there's not gains in test scores. And so therefore, you know, it doesn't matter. So addressing, it's like, wait, poverty is not hunger. Hunger is a part of poverty, but poverty is that constant living in distress of never knowing, not being safe, not knowing where you're going to wake up, not knowing where your next meal is coming from, not knowing who's going to be home with you the next time. It's that constant level of living with uncertainty. Do you understand? You know, and so that, it's such a distortion of poverty when somebody just says, well, we fed kids and it didn't work.
Right. Well, it gets back to a very deep culture of the denial of class.
Right.
Nigel's telling us that we got a bunch of people, four now, lined up in the queue with a question or comment for Dr. Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood. Let's go to the phones. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. Good afternoon to the two of you. I don't know if you already talked about this, but while we're talking about the pragmatics of education and metrics and things like this, I'm wondering if you have already talked about the cultural value that education has in the United States of America, and that is that we don't value education. We don't value educated people. We used to make disparaging remarks about intellectuals as eggheads. We had a president, Reagan, whose claim to fame was that he was a common man, you know? And so here we are talking about how to improve something that is not valued. I mean, if we're talking about how great the scores are in Asia, is part of that having to do with the fact that they value education and that education is really the process of passing along knowledge and valuing knowledge. And in America, being knowledgeable is a dangerous thing because then you start to think and question.
I think, you know what, I think some of what you're saying, you know, is true. Some of it's interesting. You know, I always thought it was funny, too, that when people would say, you know, I'm not going to vote for that guy. I'd rather vote for the other guy because he's more like me and I want to have a beer with him. And, you know, he's, you know, it's like, wait, you're saying you don't want the smartest person in charge. You want a person like me and you, you know, average people in charge of the world. That's kind of silly, isn't it? You know, whether that speaks to our valuing, you know, as a culture, education or not, I think people do have a sense of value. I think what they're understanding now is that they're not getting a deep, rich education that can transform lives. And so, you know, I've always go back and forth on whether America as a culture doesn't value education, because I think we do, because I think people, you know, if somebody's willing to spend $40,000 to $50,000 a year for K-12 education and they have that kind of money, there's a value there. So I'm not sure that it's much as a cultural thing, but I get what you're saying though too, that in traditional or just conversations, this idea that particularly our leadership and people in places of high power, the idea that we don't want them to be smart people, that's silly.
Yeah, I mean, it goes the great U.S. historian Richard Hofstadter many years ago wrote this book on anti-intellectualism in American life, and that's a strand, a theme that runs through that. Our caller said it referred to the egghead and so on. But again, as you point out, those that are looking to reform others' education value education very greatly.
I like the way you said that right there. Those who are looking to reform others' education, and that's what I said, when you're trying to fix my child's education but not yours, and in fact you're insisting that your child get something different than mine, I'm questioning your reform motives.
Let's go back to the phones. We have quite a number of people who want to get in with a comment or question. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Is that me?
Go ahead, me.
Yeah, I have a question, and this is particularly relevant to the situation in Madison, I think, but most anywhere where there's an affluent district and colors the conversation. In kind of a race-tinged way, which is that one of the limits that keeps people who have more of a liberatory kind of philosophy about education from fully advocating for the kinds of real, like really genuinely great public education we could have is that there's this sort of unspoken, or sometimes it's even spoken, kind of a fear that if we, this community, say, like people who live in Madison, taxpayers, meaning, really invest in our district in the way that we all probably agree that it should be invested in, there's a fear that poor people will move here to take advantage of it from other places, particularly big cities. So I wonder if you could comment on that kind of like xenophobia that plays out in the conversation, and what it means in terms of having to address these issues and problems outside of just our district. And
thank
think
you,
beyond just our district. Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
thank
it's you know, I mean, a lot. There's a lot there that you just threw out there. However, and in fact, we've said this. John Kuhn has said this. You know, if we truly, you know, do we have a public education crisis in this country? The answer is, yeah. You know what? The historic underfunding of people who live in the wrong zip code, people of the wrong color, people of the wrong ethnicity. You know, that's a perpetual problem in public school, and that's a funding issue because we don't do that, particularly now too in quote times of austerity, right? Because we just don't have enough money to educate your kids. Okay, well, first of all, that's nonsense. If we wanted the best education system in the American system, I will tell you the first thing that we would do is that Slecker, me, Tim, would not pay $1,000 back to the feds in income taxes while ExxonMobil gets a $10 million refund check. Okay, yep. That's austerity planned. Okay, right. You know, because, so, but if we want to do what the caller's talking about, though, if we talk about this and say we need to go into, in fact, if Madison wants to have the best school district, we've got some amazing, great schools, largely located within areas, right, where we can predict. Where are our schools that are having the biggest challenges? Let's invest right now in what we know would make a difference. First thing, and Stephen Crash in UCLA keeps saying this over and over and over again, a minimal investment in just health care for children, nutrition for children, and access to books for children would be one great, amazing thing that would actually do something to address the opportunity gap, not the achievement gap, because the achievement gap is just a measure of the opportunities that we don't give kids. But if you really want to address the achievement gap, you will address the opportunities that kids don't have, and that is access to medicine, access to food, access to books, just those three simple things. Now, that's a simplistic way to help kids. What the caller's talking about? We should be offering children who come from our most distressed communities, those kids, those who we would say the least among us, they should be getting the most, the best of everything, because understand, they're not getting those things outside of the school. So when we say, what are the contributing factors? So beyond this, right, you know, how many times do I have access to books as a child between the ages of 0 and 3? Okay. How many museums have my parents taken me to? How many airplanes have I flown on? All of those things count incredibly. If we're not going to if we know a population of children aren't coming to school with those experiences and things like that, therefore then the public school needs to step up and offer even more, because that's what's going to help.
You know, my wife and I were in London several years ago, and this friend of mine in London took us on a tour. Mm-hmm. And we went into some museums and galleries in London, and there were school groups all over the place.
Right.
And my friend said to me, he said, admission is free in all museums, libraries, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, and that came out of a social struggle.
Right.
That is... I said, you know, you go to the Art Institute of Chicago, it's, what, $18 to walk in the door now?
Right.
But this place was loaded with school groups, tours, mm-hmm. you know, kids sitting on the floors everywhere and so on. Just so the contrast was so clear.
Well, it's a recognition, too, of, you know, what are the purposes of art and museums and things like that? You know, is it a commercial thing to make money on, or is it something to appreciate, particularly with kids?
Let's go back to the phones. We have, hello, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, earlier your guest talked about one of the real problems with public education is a failure of the public academics, the public intellectuals to speak out. But, you know, I think there's a real problem when they lack tenure, when the best they can hope for is an adjunct professor position with no benefits, you know, maybe no job at the end of a semester. And it seems to me that the Catholic universities would be in a perfect position to do something about this. The Pope could simply say, we're not going to hire these adjunct professors. We're going to hire professors that have academic freedom. I think that would be a, and I know there's some movement in this direction, and it would I think it would, this Pope seems to be inclined to do things that matter, so it would really be helpful, I think, if he would do something like that. I'd like to hear your guest's comments.
I think you're addressing, well first of all, I have no idea what the Pope's going to do in my connection to the larger Catholic Church, even though I work at Edgewood University as a Catholic college. But what the Pope's going to do in that may be way beyond my ability to comment. Commenting on the fact of, you know, has there been a reduction of academic freedom, a reduction of full-time faculty members at institutions of higher learning? Absolutely, he's right. You know, and what does that do? That really serves to, particularly for those few people who are in the few tenured track positions or things like that, keeps them quiet, keeps them nervous. You know, we know that. But my response now, more and more that I think about this and I come back at this, is that okay? If that's true, so the answer to that then is to not talk about it. Even though talking about it is risky, I get it. I understand that. I mean, I'm fully conscious of talking about issues that could be problematic that might cost you your job. However, if that's truly the ethos that we live in, how is it then that not talking about it is going to do anything to help you? See, you know what I mean? So it traps you. And so I've been talking to more teacher groups and talking to them about saying, you know, they're complaining about, you know, there's too much standardized testing. There's too much. I don't have any freedom to teach anymore. I don't have this to do. You know, my life, I'm being judged by test scores. And I said, yes, I know. Why are you going? When are you going to say something about it? Right. And they'll say, well, I can't because I'll get fired. And they're right. Or they'll have some type of retribution. But I then follow up with, okay, and if you say nothing, continue to say nothing, what's going to happen? What's going to continue to get worse? Right. Okay, so it's a really crappy place to be. However, I'm more and more inclined to say, look, if anything's going to change, more and more people, you know, if we want more academic freedom and more tenure track positions, if we want more teachers with smaller class sizes with great curricular materials, people need to be willing to say that's what we want.
256-2001. Let's just say some of the rhetoric of the reformers. We hear regularly, as an example, that choice is the civil rights movement of the 20th century.
Right.
We hear that there's this kind of, one of the panaceas these days is distance learning, that we can
efficiency.
That's a right. constant. Efficiency and uplift as the constants right. of in American history. But that one this kind of dismantling of public education sold as a choice option is fantastic.
Yeah, you know, and the people on that side have been great about framing, you know, which they always are. They come out and frame this as, you know, well, shouldn't anybody who has a child in a failing school have a choice to send that child to somewhere else? You know, and of course you sit there and go, no, I think they should actually keep their kid in that failing school because that's their fault. Yeah, you know, nobody's going to say that, you know, but it's a false idea to say that the answer then is to provide choice, because what you're not addressing is the fact that, wait a minute, every child, if there is supposedly a failing school, which again that notion bothers me in and of itself, but let's play with it anyway. Why would I give those children a choice to get out of it? And why is the choice not the fact that everybody in that school deserves then whatever it is that we need to do to fix that entire failing school? Why do only some kids get to choose to leave it? Why, you know, so this idea of choice, right. What it's trying to say is that, again, we only have certain resources, and we're only going to let a few get out, right? So if we save a couple.
Right. This gets to this whole issue of voucher schools.
Yeah, which is
voucher charter,
which is silly. You know, I mean, the first statistic people should know about vouchers is that the majority of people using vouchers are using them to supplement. They were already in private schools to begin with, okay? Which, you know, there you go. Okay, if my child was already in private schools and now I'm just using a voucher to help defray the costs, did I need that voucher to begin with? Okay, and we know, you know, we have an obligation to fund equitably a public education system in this country, in which we fail to continue to do. And instead, we keep coming up with schemes such as vouchers, such as charter schools, such as choice, and we frame that and we always take the child and the family that's seems to be the brunt of that, and. It's not a really productive way. It's right wing rhetoric that confuses us from looking at what we really need to say is, kids don't need choices. Kids need the absolute guarantee that they get a great education system in the community they live in.
You know, we got several people, and we got 10 minutes left. I'm going to try and get everybody in. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the subject. I come at this from a little bit of a different perspective. I think the public education system has been stunningly successful currently and historically, in that it has created a population that accepts that there is no alternative. And it's been particularly successful with what has been called the coordinating class. Those of many of them in Madison are of this class who keep the trains running on time. And what's this leading to is, you know, on a personal level, many people who are work-consumed die with Prozac to help them along. And on a planetary level, well, I think we see what we're doing there. So I think the indoctrination system, that is the public education system, has worked as well as the elites could have hoped for, and I'm a little surprised they're trying to dismantle it.
Thank you, Carl.
Yeah, that is a good point. I bring that up, and sometimes when I teach policy classes, you know, when we really truly look at the structure of the American public education system, is it this Jeffersonian model, which says that, you know, we need illiterate citizenship to make sure that we have a democracy, or is it this kind of Prussian model which trains people to go out and do what they're told and be compliant? I think the answer is yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the education system would collapse in and of itself if it wasn't reproducing the order.
Yeah, and it does, and I think those are bigger and larger discussions.
Right.
However, we're not going to get out of and move into a direction of liberating education until we really start to move in a different direction.
Now, Tim, I imagine there's a number of our listeners today who are thinking, well, this is interesting, perhaps, mm-hmm. but it really doesn't affect me. I'm not connected to the schools.
Right.
I don't have any kids. I'm single. I'm this. I'm that.
Right.
How and why is it important in that bigger picture?
Well, there's a great study by Scott Witkoff, and he put this out there. And he said, you know, show me a failing school, and I'll show you a suffering community. Show you a suffering community, I'll show you a suffering school. So the connection there. Okay, so, yes, you don't have kids anymore in this school. Right, so therefore you should not pay taxes. I used to have this argument with my grandfather all the time. He's like, you know, I shouldn't pay taxes anymore, you know. And this is Clairton, Pennsylvania, which used to be and slowly he watched, you know, Clairton die. Now, not largely just because of the school system, but the idea though was, you know, you are going to get, in fact, a community that resembles your commitment to public education. It just, you know, that isn't. So we should be. That's why you care about it. Because, you know what? It's the same thing about caring about your neighbor's employment. You know, when your next door neighbor loses their job, that's bad for everybody who lives in that community. So when you have a public school system that's underfunded, with kids that aren't being given the necessary resources to learn at the levels they can. Okay, that's a problem for you because your community is going to bear the resemblance of that same type of, just nasty things that occur when we do that. I don't.
Right, the social cost. I'm gonna have time for one more caller, and then we're gonna head toward wrap up.
Sure.
I want to talk about what can we do, what is to be done.
Sure.
So let's take our last caller. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello there. First of all, I want to say I really appreciate the programming that you guys do between noon and one, and today especially. I'm an educator myself. I wanted to make a comment about the hierarchies that say we need to do this, that, and the other thing to improve education, where they're actually going the other way. And my understanding of those people and their actions is that they want to be in power. They don't want an intelligent populace to threaten what they do and correct what they don't do. And I think this is a big problem in the dysfunctional society that they have created in the United States.
Thank you, Colin.
Yeah, and I, I've heard this before. In fact, one of the other callers kind of alluded to that point that, what we're really engaged in here in education reform is creating a system that actually creates even more compliance and more obeying and this false idea that if you do well on certain schools, the success in public schools really means that we've created, we've stripped away from you the idea that you have any independent thoughts and that your idea is that you're going to go out and make, a couple bucks, have a couple kids, go on vacation, and never question the hierarchy of the system. Okay, it's an accurate point. Now, what do we do about that? I know that's where you were saying you want to go, Alan. Well, even despite the caller who said, the first thing is that people, not just like me, but yeah, people in positions, and so people in positions of leadership dealing with education, right? They need to speak up. They need to talk about what's right, what's wrong, when things are happening. When I read about teachers and I talk to teachers who sit there and tell me, I know that I am being asked to do something that's developmentally inappropriate for children. Okay, well, who is asking you to do that? And it comes out, school leadership. Okay, school leadership, if you don't know that, and I've met some leaders who will say, I know I'm being asked or told to do things that are, okay, you got to stop. Okay, I mean, people need to really start getting a little bit of courage and recognize that these are children that we're doing these things to. So when we're experimenting with high-stakes testing and sorting and trying new types of methodologies for teaching, we're experimenting on other people's kids, okay? If we know that some of these things are horrifically wrong and are inappropriate and maybe harmful or even hurtful, you have an obligation as a professional, whether you're a teacher, whether you're a principal, whether you're a superintendent, to stop the unethical use, the inhumane, this idea of malpractice. We have malpractice in education. So right now, our standards-driven, high-stakes test-based, do away with all of the extra things that really matter. That's educational malpractice, and we're funding that as reform. First of all, we need to call it what it is, educational malpractice. Call it what, understand that it's being underfunded on purpose, that the failing schools narrative is created to continue this on purpose. People need to call it out and talk about it, and that's why we've been trying to have the reclaiming the conversations that we're going to be, continue to do at Edgewood. And, after John Kuhn, after Karen Lewis spoke, we had that first meeting at Edgewood. We're going to have another one coming up in June. The other thing is I would tell people, and here's going to be a self-promotional plug, is that there are people out there talking. So my colleague and I do a show called At the Chalk Face on Blog Talk Radio on Sunday nights, every Sunday night at 5 o'clock. This time my co-host on the East Coast, so it's 6 o'clock Eastern. And we have on everybody from Karen Lewis to parents, and we talk about these issues dealing with education, okay? You've got to get educated about what's happening. And so, At the Chalk Face, the other thing with with this.
Does that have a URL? Or?
You can go to atthechalkface.com, you know, atthechalkface.com, no spaces, and then you'll have a click that will put you into Blog Talk Radio. The other thing is to, you know, look, you know, we also have moved into where we're with a group called MX2 Media. MX2 Media is trying to syndicate the show. The idea to have, I love that you had me on, but we've got to have bigger commitments and bigger forums to continue this talk.
Well, we're right down to the end of the hour. You've been listening this hour to Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College. I want to thank Nigel and Devin, and you, our callers, our listeners, and of